Welcome to the 17th Annual Nostra Italia Dialogue. The general objective of the dialogue is actually the topic of tonight's event. My name is Father George Hunt. I am the director of the Archbishop Hughes Institute, which is the sponsor and organizer of this event. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Stephen Friedman, who is the Senior Vice President here at Fordham, who would like to also, on behalf of Fordham, offer his welcoming words. Dr. Friedman.
Thank you.
Thank you, Father. It is my privilege and great pleasure to welcome all of you this evening to the Future of Catholic-Jewish Interfaith Dialogue, sponsored by the Archbishop Hughes Institute on Religion and Culture at Fordham University. We are especially honored tonight by the presence of our two distinguished presenters. I want to extend, on behalf of Father McShane and all of us at Fordham, a very warm welcome to His Excellency Timothy Dolan, Archbishop of New York, and Dr. Arnold Eisen, the Chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary. I also would like to acknowledge our wonderful moderator this evening, Dr. Edward Bristow, Professor of History at Fordham University. Both Ed and Father Hunt have played seminal roles in creating this vibrant forum. These interfaith dialogues have made and continue to make an important contribution to Catholic-Jewish relations. First, I believe, by honestly acknowledging an historically difficult and challenging relationship. And secondly, more importantly, by moving us forward on a fruitful path that fosters respectful and affirming engagement. It means a great deal to me personally that we are having this discussion about the future of Catholic-Jewish dialogue here at Fordham University at this time. I am exceptionally proud to be here this evening, and I am so proud of my institution, Fordham University, for hosting this event. I remember vividly, many years ago, His Eminence Joseph Cardinal Bernardin choosing Mundelein College at Loyola University of Chicago, where I was serving as dean, to give his first public address as cardinal on ecumenism. The impact of his message was extraordinarily powerful for me. It was a message of openness, mutual respect, and genuine fellowship in exploring the dialogue between faith and reason for both the Catholic and other faith traditions. I was deeply touched by his invitation to full participation in bringing the wisdom inherent in all religious traditions to bear on the fundamental questions of human existence and our relation to God. As I have gotten to know our new Archbishop in the past few months, I feel very, very fortunate to have amongst us such a person of great compassion and love. He is a man for all people, caring and concerned for others. I know that he will have a profound impact here in New York and throughout the nation and indeed around the world as this Jewish-Catholic dialogue we are beginning tonight is expanded and strengthened in time. New York is the ideal place for this dialogue to continue. Chancellor Eisen, please know how welcome you are at Fordham University. Not only do we welcome you as an educator and scholar, but as a true friend and colleague. Fordham, the Jesuit University of New York, is the home for all of us who believe in the love of God and the love of each other. Your Excellency and Chancellor Eisen, we at Fordham want you to know how very important both your voices are in this interfaith conversation. We celebrate your participation and engagement in shaping an ongoing dialogue that will immeasurably enrich our institutions, our lives, and our common spiritual heritage. I thank you for joining us as we explore together our religious heritage with honor, with respect, and for profound appreciation for our two religious traditions. Thank you.
Thank you, Stephen. Well said. Well said.
At this time, it's my great pleasure and honor to introduce the moderator of tonight's event, Dr. Edward Briscoe.
Thank you very much, Father Hunt and Dr. Friedman. Before our distinguished speakers address the future of dialogue, I would like to say a few words about its past. In 1974, the Vatican's new Commission on Religious Relations with the Jews issued a set of guidelines for implementing Nostra Aetate, which had actually been promulgated 9 years earlier in 1965. Part one of the guidelines began, quote, "To tell the truth, such relations as there have been between Jew and Christian have scarcely even risen to the level of monologue. From now on, real dialogue must be established," close quote. Cardinal Willebrand's call for friendly talks, joint study, joint prayer. While dialogue had actually begun appearing in the 1960s and even in the 1950s, it proliferated in every dimension following the encouragement by these guidelines. Internationally, Vatican officials now meet regularly with Jewish leaders. Within the United States, the Conference of Catholic Bishops consults with denominational organizations of rabbis. In most major cities, we have meetings among religious leaders. There are textual study groups, joint scholarly projects, university study centers, and many well-established speaker series, including, of course, our own. Our Fordham series has been rewarding to all involved. We've ranged across from some familiar but important territory, from the Holocaust to programs in applied religious ethics, the sort of thing that Jonathan Sacks, the British chief rabbi, calls dialogue, quote, "conducted in the universal language of common humanity." At the Great Rome Synagogue, Pope John Paul II in 1986 spoke of the same thing by referring to collaboration in favor of man. Unusually, at least half of our own programs here at Fordham, half of our 16 programs, this is our 17th, have been concerned with theological issues. And that's the approach that Robert Wilkin, one of our earlier speakers, emphasizes as the central mutual concern. Dialogue has transformed Jewish-Catholic relations, as Dr. Friedman was suggesting. Dialogue has indeed transformed Catholic-Jewish relations. New research on the parting of the ways has established fresh insights about Jesus and Paul and altered Catholic teaching about Judaism. The document Dabru Emet, issued in 2000 and signed by several hundred rabbis and Jewish scholars by this point, hopefully has begun the process of delineating the path to a new Jewish understanding of Christianity. There have also been challenges. Within each community, the laity lags behind scholars and dialogue leaders. Orthodox Jews are relatively reluctant to participate. Moreover, in the past decade, a series of issues has arisen between the dialogue partners. from the availability to scholars of Pius XII's wartime papers to, most recently, the U.S. bishop's revised statement regarding dialogue and the evangelization of the Jews. We have suggestions about how to resolve some of these issues. At its July conference in Berlin, for example, the International Council of Christians and Jews adopted a time for recommitment, which is a long set of recommendations about how to move the conversation forward. Our distinguished guests speak with special authority about the future of interfaith dialogue. Each is an inspirational religious leader who has recently come to New York amid widespread acclaim to take up challenging responsibilities of the highest order. Each is a scholar and practitioner of dialogue. Father Timothy Dolan was installed as Archbishop of New York on April 15th of this year. He hails from Missouri and was ordained there in 1976. He then earned a doctorate on American church history at the Catholic University, served as a parish priest in St. Louis, and for 5 years was secretary to the Vatican diplomatic mission in Washington. In 1992, he returned to St. Louis to become vice rector and professor of church history at the seminary. From 1994 to 2001, he served as rector of the Pontifical North American College in Rome, the seminary where he had completed his own formation. Father Dolan was Archbishop of Milwaukee before his appointment to New York, and he is the author of Priests for the Third Millennium. Archbishop Dolan has described his interfaith work as intensely rewarding and enriching. And the Jewish community in Milwaukee will not soon forget the Archbishop's visit to Congregation Shalom in 2005 when he called the bar mitzvah celebrant to the Bima and gave him his skull cap. And so you know what sort of thing about that. Finally, if I may, I want to mention another sensitive dimension of the Archbishop's work here in New York. Now that the Phillies have been disposed of, and with regrets to Chancellor Eisen, who, as you will learn, hails from Philadelphia, the question... of the moment is simply this, Yanks or Mets. Last Father's Day, Archbishop Dolan was interviewed on WFAN radio by Ed Randall, who in fact is a Fordham graduate. And Archbishop Dolan explained that the Mets were traditionally supported by the Diocese of Brooklyn and Rockville Center, while the New York Archdiocese supports the Yankees. May I suggest that Father McShane has already done enough for the Yankees. He threw out a first pitch at the Yankee Stadium earlier in the season, and that the Mets need all the help that they can get. Like Archbishop Dolan, Chancellor Arnold Eisen has been centrally concerned with the training of religious leaders and the renewal of religious community. For many years, before 2007, it hasn't been that long yet, when he took the reins of the Jewish Theological Seminary, the flagship institution of conservative Judaism, he devoted himself to short residencies at synagogues throughout the United States, aimed at the building of what he has described as communities of Torah, religious communities that enable the dialogue with tradition that is the basis for all authentic Jewish activity. After studying at the University of Pennsylvania and at Oxford, Chancellor Eisen earned his doctorate in the history of Jewish thought at the Hebrew University. Prior to 2007, he was Koshland Professor of Jewish Culture and Religion at Stanford, and he has also taught at Columbia and Tel Aviv universities. Chancellor Eisen's acute understanding of the conditions of modernity, as well as of Jewish traditions, inform a brilliant body of work that is widely considered to be authoritative on American Judaism and Jewish life. He is the recipient of the National Jewish Book Award. In his 1997 book, Taking Hold of Torah, Chancellor Eisen has described how he was influenced as a 16-year-old by Abraham Joshua Heschel's book, God in Search of Man, and by a lengthy interview with a generous Heschel that he conducted as an undergraduate reporter at Penn. Of Heschel, Chancellor Eisen has said that, quote, he gave us the tools of religious dialogue. These are tools that Chancellor Eisen employs with great effect. Let our dialogue now begin. Each speaker will talk for about 25 minutes, with Archbishop Dolan speaking first. Each speaker will then comment on the other's comments, and at that point we will turn to you for questions from the floor. Our aim is to finish by about 10 to 8 or so, but don't be misled by the clock, which has not been turned back to.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Father Hunt and Dr. Friedman, and thanks to the Archbishop Hughes Institute on Religion and Culture for organizing this prestigious annual Nostra Aetate lecture. I also want to greet Dr. Edward Bristow, a distinguished historian and the creator of this series, named, as you know, after the epic decree of the Second Vatican Council, which began, we can say without risk of exaggeration, began a new chapter in the Catholic Church's relationship with other religions, especially with the Jewish people, with whom we Christians are bound by the strongest of spiritual ties. I want to acknowledge as well the gracious presence of my co-presenter, Dr. Arnold Eisen, Chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, renowned scholar of contemporary Judaism and Jewish thought. It's an honor to share the podium with you this evening, Arnie. And I see my friend Father McShane, the president of Fordham University, in the back. Good Catholic that he is, he's sitting in the back pew there. So, do you have that problem in synagogues, Chancellor Eisen, of the good ones sitting in the back? Now, everybody, my presentation this evening is going to be in two parts. First, the first part is going to try to assess the developments in Jewish-Catholic relations since the election of Pope Benedict XVI in April of 2005, and then the other is going to try to propose some areas of common reflection for Catholic and Jewish leadership in the United States. As you might imagine, now as the Catholic Archbishop in a community that is home to the largest Jewish population in the world, I am very much committed to deepening the friendship that providentially already exists between our two communities. I'm likewise committed to extending our dialogue in new areas of common study and of witnessing to the human values that are of crucial importance to the renewal of the society, citizenship in which we both share. All right? First, let me take a look at Jewish-Catholic relations from 2005 to the present. All right? Relations between the Catholic Church and the Jewish people are, to use appropriately a biblical metaphor, like a house built on solid ground. It can endure, experience tells us. It can endure the buffeting winds of whatever storm might tear down another house built on a less secure foundation. This is because the builders of this house have been master architects, people like Pope John the 23rd, Cardinal Augustine Bea, Abraham Joshua Heschel, and Jules Isaac. Over recent years, many in this country have added to the splendid edifice that is the post Nostra Aetate relationship between Catholics and Jews, for which we all must be very grateful. You won't mind if I invoke the memory of my predecessor, Cardinal John O'Connor, and his esteemed colleague, Rabbi Mark Tannenbaum, both tireless advocates for Jewish-Christian dialogue and continued collaboration. In the last couple of years, we've lost two indefatigable educators, Rabbi Leon Klinicki and Sister Rose Theron, who provided, talk about practical, who provided publishers of textbooks and teachers with the principles by which they could teach about the other with respect and historical candor. As you probably know, we Catholics often measure our church history by papacies. And I want to acknowledge that advances in Jewish-Catholic relations would not have happened without the vigorous leadership of the servant of God, Pope John Paul II, and of his successor, Pope Benedict XVI. Both popes have placed fostering Jewish-Catholic relations at the top of the Church's agenda. John Paul II's historic pilgrimage to the Holy Land in 2000, during which he placed at the Western Wall in Jerusalem the unforgettable prayer for forgiveness for the past sins of Catholics against Jews, is only one incident that provides eloquent testimony to that. Benedict XVI has made similar gestures of outreach from the very first year of his pontificate, when he became the second pope in history to visit a synagogue, this time in Cologne, Germany. Soon, as you probably have heard, he will visit the synagogue of Rome, as his predecessor did about 25 years ago, where he can be expected to affirm the enduring presence of Rome's Jewish community as a testimony to God's providential love. And of course, we in this community we love cannot forget his visit to a synagogue here in New York a year and a half ago, a visit, I am told, he himself insisted upon. Like John Paul II, he has regularly condemned anti-Semitism, acknowledged the profound spiritual bond between the Jewish people and the historic land of Israel, and affirmed that Jewish faith and witness is internal to our own Christian identity. No pope has invoked the memory of the Holocaust of the Jews under the Third Reich as often and with such eloquence as Benedict XVI. You might recall, after standing in prolonged silence at the Yad Vashem in Jerusalem on May 5th of this last year, the Pope gave a brief talk in which he said that the millions of Jews who lost their lives in the Shoah will never lose their names because they are forever fixed in the memory of God. Even more, he submitted, they are etched on the hearts of all those determined never to allow such an atrocity to disgrace humanity again. Now, we got to be realistic, everybody, and we also have to admit that in the course of the present pontificate, there have also been occasions of tension, resulting, I would propose, mostly from misunderstanding. And can I mention a couple of these? For instance, the publication of the Holy Father's Motu Proprio of July 7, 2007, giving permission for a wider usage of the Roman Missal of 1962 in the celebration of our liturgy. This older form of the Roman Catholic Mass contains that infamous and offensive Good Friday prayer for the conversion of Jews, which, as you might imagine, immediately attracted attention. The following February 2nd, Pope Benedict issued a personally revised version of the prayer, which did remove historic stereotypes depicting Jews as spiritually blind and needing to be delivered from their darkness. This new prayer asks, to the dissatisfaction, we must admit, of many of our Jewish partners, that God illumine the hearts of Jews so that they may acknowledge Jesus Christ as the Savior of all people. Jewish reactions to the revision of this prayer, as you will not be surprised to note, were one of disappointment, since many had hoped that the Pope would simply substitute the old Good Friday prayer with the one now in use from the 1970 Missal, which prays, without any explicit reference to conversion, simply that Jews may grow in the love of God's name and in fidelity to the covenant. This disappointment, I hope, has been mitigated somewhat, I'm told by my Jewish colleagues, by an interpretation given to that revised prayer by Cardinal Walter Kasper, the president of the Pontifical Commission for Religious Relations with Jews. The cardinal explained in April of 2008 in an article in L'Osservatore Romano that the prayer should only be understood as an eschatological confidence on the part of Christians that indeed all Jews will be included in the final community of God's elect at the end of time. The Church respects, the cardinal asserted, Jewish covenantal life and renounces any missionary program that is aimed specifically at converting Jews to Christianity. Another incident. One minority segment of Catholicism devoted to that older form of the Mass is what's called the Society of St. Pius X, whose founder, the late Marcel Lefebvre, led his followers into schism from the Catholic Church back in 1988 when he ordained four bishops without the consent of the Pope. Lefebvre had been a staunch critic of Vatican II, especially the Council's teachings on religious freedom and dialogue with other religions, Nostra Aetate. As prefect for the Congregation of the Doctrine of the Faith, Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger had been involved in delicate negotiations with that society. And it was his hope that reconciliation with the traditionalist followers of Lefebvre might be possible if their legitimate devotion to the older form of the Mass could in some ways be validated by the Holy See. Once the motu proprio was issued in 2007, expectations were raised about the possibility of ending the schism. But Pope Benedict took the occasion of the 50th anniversary of Blessed John XXIII's calling of the Council as an opportunity to make what was intended to be a magnanimous gesture. Rather than first negotiate toward agreement and on outstanding difficulties with the Council and the unlawful ordinations of the four bishops, the Pope agreed that he would first remove the excommunications of the four bishops and then set up a process for dialogue. But the Holy Father was blindsided by a development that had sadly escaped the attention of his staff, because one of the four bishops, you can remember, Richard Williamson, had been interviewed for Swedish television and conveyed his reprehensible views denying the reality and scope of the Holocaust. It had appeared at first blush that the Pope had rehabilitated a Holocaust denier, who was now a functioning bishop of the Catholic Church. The Holy See came in for an avalanche of criticism from Jewish as well as from Catholic leaders, not to mention some representatives of secular governments. And in the following weeks, the status of Williamson and the other bishops was clarified. Though they were no longer excommunicated, they still could not lawfully exercise ministry as Catholic bishops until they had accepted the Church's teaching in its totality, including the teaching of the document we celebrate this evening, Nostra Aetate. The Pope then took numerous occasions to reaffirm the Church's unequivocal condemnation of anti-Semitism and determination to honor the memory of the 6 million Jews who had perished in the Shoah. In a letter to us, bishops of the Church, Benedict XVI acknowledged the hard lessons learned through this painful ordeal. The ironic conclusion that Pope Benedict drew from the affair in his letter is worth quoting. Listen, a gesture of reconciliation with a group engaged in a process of separation thus sadly turned into its very antithesis, an apparent step backwards with regard to all the steps of reconciliation between Christians and Jews taken since the Council, steps which my own work as a theologian had sought from the beginning to take part in and support. Another incident. Here in the United States, we bishops have learned that efforts to address internal, what we thought was internal Catholic Church problems, can sometimes, guess what, spill over to our ecumenical and interreligious relationships. Let me give you some examples. Last June, two of our standing committees of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops issued what's called a note clarifying ambiguities that we bishops believe were contained in a Catholic-Jewish dialogue statement from 2002 entitled Reflections on Covenant and Mission. Our conference had received expressions of reservations from some scholars and Catholics about some of the claims in Reflections. Among them was the observation that Reflections was somewhat ambiguous about the role of Jesus Christ as the unique Savior of all people, and also that the dialogue statement seemed to question whether it is ever appropriate for a Jew to become a Christian. Well, to address those ambiguities, our doctrinal and ecumenical interreligious committees published the note, which affirmed Catholic belief in Christ as the unique Savior, who fulfills all God's previous promises and covenants made with Israel, and which stated that Christians have a responsibility at all times to witness to Jesus Christ. Yet the seventh paragraph of the note made use of a
unfortunate expression that suggested to our Jewish partners that our dialogues with them could be an occasion for inviting them to baptism and abandoning their own faith. A letter signed by a coalition of five leading Jewish organizations, an address to Cardinal Francis George, the president of our bishops' conference, and Cardinal William Keeler, the moderator for Jewish affairs, and several other conference officials, contended that once Jewish-Catholic dialogue has been formally characterized as an invitation, whether explicit or implicit, to apostatize, then Jewish participation becomes untenable. I should further note that our Jewish partners were also reacting during this time to a change that had been made in the United States Catholic Catechism for Adults, in a passage that also treated this all-important topic of the covenant. See, the original version of the passage in question had spoken of God's covenant with Moses as being eternally valid for the Jews, a position that to some seemed at odds with what Catholics hear during the consecration at Mass, namely, that the covenant made in the blood of Christ is the new and everlasting covenant. Well, the Bishop's Committee on Catechesis proposed a substitution for this paragraph, which, with the settled Catholic teaching, found in Nostra Aetate, paragraph 4. And the revised text, adopted by the entire conference in 2008, repeats what is found in Vatican II and the Universal Catechism, quote, "To the Jewish people, whom God first chose to hear his word, belong the sonship, the glory, the covenants, the giving of the law, the worship, and the promises. To them belong the patriarchs, and of their race according to the flesh is the Christ." Despite efforts to explain this change as a matter of choosing settled doctrine over a theological position that requires way too much explanation, the USCCB came in for a lot of criticism from those who sensed a further pullback from the Church's commitment to Nostra Aetate and to respecting Jewish faith on its own terms. I'm happy tonight to report, which probably is not news to you since you wouldn't be here if you were not sensitive to this valuable dialogue, these recent tensions, which I have tried to outline, found a degree of resolution on October 6th when Cardinal George and four other bishops responded to the coalition letter from Jewish leaders mentioned a second ago by announcing that the note would be revised by excising the two problematic sentences of paragraph 7. The bishops also issued a statement of six Catholic principles for its dialogue with Jews, and among the principles is the acknowledgement that, quote, "Jewish covenantal life endures to the present day as a vital witness to God's saving will for his people, Israel, and for all of humanity." Most critical to the relationship was the assurance that the dialogue, quote, "has never been and never will be used by the Catholic Church as a means of proselytism, nor is it a disguised invitation to baptism. In sitting at the table," the bishop said, "we expect to encounter Jews who are utterly faithful to the Mosaic Covenant, just as we insist that only Catholics committed to the teachings of the Church would encounter them in our dialogues." In a final letter to Cardinal George and the bishops who composed the statement, the Jewish coalition welcomed the fact that our Episcopal Conference not only heard the concerns of Jews of the issue, but, quote, "are making efforts to be responsive to them. We were deeply troubled," the Jewish leaders went on, "by the original wording of this document, and now we hope that this welcome development will put our dialogue back on a positive track." My own hope, everybody, is the same. We cannot afford crises of this nature to divert our attention from other pressing issues that Jews and Catholics have got to face together. Among the items on our agenda that warrant further scholarly research and discussion would be precisely the nature of the covenants that God has made with his people. Jewish understandings of covenantal relationships have to be factored into the ways in which we Christians reflect on the distinctive relationship that we believe is brought about by the life death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We found out that our own Catholic theology can only be enriched when Catholics and Jews together explore themes that are found, however distinctly, in their respective traditions. And you know what? Among the fruits of Post Nostra Aetate dialogue is an emerging awareness that by tending to the ways in which Jews continue to find themselves as a people of faith, we Catholics discover a valuable resource for deepening our own self-understanding as believers. Now I want to get to my second and last part, kind of a look at the future, what I might call a proposal for our dialogue agenda. If our recent discussions have deepened our awareness of the need for mutual respect of the other's identity, let me suggest that our future conversation might profitably examine the ways in which the two communities are seeking to strengthen the spiritual identities of their members in a cultural context of religious individualism that is rather inimical and inimical to both Jewish and Catholic understanding. You're all familiar with the U.S. Religious Landscape Survey released last year by the Pew Forum. You know that it confirms the impact of both secularization and patterns of movement from one religious affiliation to another among significant portions of our society, including Catholics and Jews. While the Catholic Church continues to be the largest religious denomination in America, holding steady in recent decades at about 25% of the population, large numbers of Catholics have left the Church. Roughly 10% of all Americans, according to Pew Research, claim to be former Catholics. In other words, approximately 30 million. Where do they go? Now, when compared with Catholics who retain their members at a rate of 68%, Jews do fare better in retaining at a rate of 76%. But that still, my Jewish colleagues tell me, is a very sobering statistic. What the Pew Report and other studies of recent decades show is something many of us in ministry and the rabbinate know intuitively. Most Catholics and Jews who break allegiance with the religion of their upbringing, do so as teenagers and young adults. My question that I think can valuably be explored by Jewish and Catholic leaders is what can be done to understand and perhaps to even stem this disturbing pattern? Can we learn from one another how religious identity is successfully being shaped by our religious communities? What are young Jews and young Catholics looking for in an age of religious individualism and of general loss of social capital in American society? Big questions, I admit. I want to suggest that we examine how our respective communities are creating for our young people what social theorists sometimes refer to as third space. Have you ever heard that term? If first space refers to the private sphere of home and family, and second space to the public spheres of work and commerce, then third space consists of a middle ground that combines elements of both familial intimacy with communal modes of interaction. Third space includes associations where people form friendships and engage in activities that contribute to the welfare of the wider community. They are home to the relational networks or mediating structures that were long ago described by Alexis de Tocqueville as characteristic of and salutary to American civic life. What I'm trying to get at is this, and I don't know if I'm having any luck or not. For both Jews and Catholics, our religion, our faith, is a given. It is inherited. We are born into it. It is part of our DNA. God chose the Jews, not the other way around. And Jesus reminded his disciples, "It is not you who chose me, but I who chose you." We Catholics call this an ecclesial reality. And while, Arnie, I don't know if the Jews use that word or not, they sure appreciate profoundly the reality. We are Jews. We are Catholics. In the same way, we are members of the human family, and belonging to a people or a church is essential for us. This has a profound spiritual and theological meaning, right? But it is hard to explain to a culture where personal individual choice trumps ontological realities. The Pew Research tells us that inherited religions, read Jews and Catholics, are facing a crisis in that today's members do not value their received religions as much as did their grandparents. People today want to believe but not belong. To engage this development is, I suggest, a pastoral project that can and must unite Catholics and Jewish pastors. And another area, and then I'll stop, is that another area that we examine together is the hunger for spirituality. Sociologist Robert Wuthnow not long ago compared religious behavior among Americans today with the behavior of the generation that came to age after World War II. In the present-day religious context, observant Jews and Christians are more likely to see themselves as seekers rather than dwellers. 50 years ago, young adults looked for a spiritual home in which they might find a spouse and raise a family. Today, they tend to migrate from church to church, from one form of religious commitment to another, often in search of community and spiritual practices that help them have an experience of God's presence and guidance in their lives. Young Catholics in Europe and the U.S. have lately shown an interest in traditional Catholic devotions and monastic meditation and the age-old practice, for instance, of making a pilgrimage to a holy site. I'm wondering how young Jews seeking to engage the discipline of Sabbath observance and the study of Torah, how they're progressing. Can we not explore together these analogous patterns of spiritual hunger among our people? Young people today are apparently saying to us, feed me spiritually, or else I'll go somewhere else to find my sustenance. And I contend that's a challenge that both Jews and Catholics need to rise to. As one rabbi friend observed to me, I'm so happy to see that the spirituality section is the fastest growing area at my local Barnes & Noble. I'm so sad to notice that there's not a classical Jewish book among the shelves. Now, I could only nod my head in agreement, as there's probably not a Catholic one there either. Once again, Jewish and Catholic pastoral leaders can come together to reclaim the spirituality section from the self-help and New Age gurus and restore the enriching, ennobling, sustaining wisdom of the ages faithfully handed on in both of our spiritual traditions. Those are only two issues, I know, and boy, there's a lot more that can engage Jews and Catholics in a dialogue over what we both consider the most pivotal issue of them all. Holiness, justice, interior peace, a purpose in life, an acceptance of God's love, mercy, and an acceptance of his invitation to life to the fullest. We owe it, my friends, to the heroes who went before us in this dialogue and to God's children who will come after us, whether they call themselves Jews or Catholics, to keep at it with love and grit and honesty and respect in friendship and in shalom of God the Most High. Thanks a lot for listening. Arnie, it's all yours, and I'm eager to hear what you have to say. I'm particularly grateful that that the Chancellor brings yet another perspective. He's, unlike myself, he also happens to be a husband and a dad, and so has immense human concerns for the passing on of the faith. Like me, he spent a good chunk of his life in training future religious leaders. So I think those two perspectives, Chancellor, are going to make your words particularly fruitful for us this evening.
Thank you. Thank you. It's an honor to be here this evening, certainly, to share the podium with the Archbishop, and thank you, Ed, for that generous introduction. You know, you're going to hear a lot of agreement between the Archbishop and me this evening. I have to say, I was hoping that we would adjourn at 8 o'clock tonight to go to watch the seventh game of the World Series. We Jews have an expression which is very apt to our situation this evening. We like to say, next year in Jerusalem. We'll apply this to Philadelphia. I look forward to another World Series next year in Philadelphia and hope that we'll do better next year. JTS has been a partner in the Nostra Aetate Dialogues from the very beginning, I'm proud to say. My colleague Bert Vysotsky was instrumental in helping to create them. My predecessor as Chancellor, Ismar Shorsh, appeared on this podium with John Cardinal O'Connor in 1995 for the discussion entitled Catholic-Jewish Dialogue in the New Millennium. Since I took over as Chancellor at JTS, we've strengthened our long-standing ties to Union Theological Seminary. We've begun a new relationship with the 96th Street Mosque and other Muslim organizations. JTS has, of course, long had relationships with Fordham and other Catholic institutions in New York, and I'm proud to report that we're well on the way to a new exchange agreement with the Gregorian University in Rome. Archbishop Dolan, I hope you will soon be able to visit JTS to meet our faculty and students and to demonstrate by your presence and your words that our faith commitments do not preclude respect for other faiths, but quite the opposite. As my teacher, Abraham Joshua Heschel, put it in his famous address of 1965, the same year as Nostra Aetate, his address called No Religion is an Island, the supreme issue today is not the halakha for Jews or the church for the Christian. The supreme issue is the premise underlying both religions, namely that there is a pathos, a divine reality concerned with the destiny of men. The question facing us is whether we are alive or dead to the challenge and the expectation of the living God. In that spirit, I want to pick up where the Archbishop ended and say a few words about where we stand today. Let's be blunt. These are very scary times. Many Americans, more than 10%, are unemployed. Many have lost their life savings in the last few months. They've lost their mortgages. They've lost their homes. Our planet is threatened in more ways than one. We are acutely concerned this year about nuclear proliferation. We have good reason to fear that soon we will be presented with air that is unbreathable, with unsafe water, with not enough water. And as if that is not enough, we have widespread political chaos in this world. We know that there are many hundreds of millions of people. I was in India this summer and saw it firsthand. Many hundreds of millions of people who live on a dollar a day. The threat of terrorism armed with shoulder-fired nuclear weapons hangs over this world like a nightmare we can't seem to escape. In short, human stewardship of this planet is not going very well at present. The more fortunate of God's creatures are not doing a great job at caring for the less fortunate. There's a lack of peace in the Middle East that is all too typical of the rest of the world and threatens to the rest of the world. And at this time, religion, which is so crucial to billions of the world's people and to many nations of the world, religion is seen in part deservedly, in particular by young people, as an agent of intolerance rather than a cure for intolerance, as an agent of hatred, of persecution, of terror. Evil is performed every day in God's name. Young people wonder why they should be religious at all, why they should think of leading the religious people of this world when religion is so often associated with hatred and too rarely, if you read the newspapers and watch the media, too rarely associated with love and with kindness. I think that those of us who stand for faith, who are religious leaders, who train religious leaders, and have an obligation, you and I have an obligation to address this situation to raise the good name of faith from the dust, to hallow God's name against those who profane it every day, to do good work in the world together, and to do it in the name of faith, in the name of God. That's why Heschel argued so passionately that our era must mark an end to complacency, to evasion, and to self-reliance by the world's religions, including Jews and Catholics. He proclaimed in No Religion as an Island, quote, Jews and Christians share the perils and the fears of this world. We unite in dialogue and more than dialogue because, as he put it, we stand on the brink of the abyss together. Let me cite one final warning from Heschel's address, more apt today than ever, sadly so. We fail to recognize that while different exponents of faith in the world of religion continue to be wary of the ecumenical movement, there is another ecumenical movement worldwide in extent and influence, nihilism. We must choose between interfaith and inter-nihilism. Jews read Lech Lecha as the portion of the week in the synagogue last Shabbat, again reading the command and the gift to Abraham to get moving, to leave the land that he knew, to set forth for a land that God would show him, this land that has always been interpreted by Jewish commentators to be both a literal land that would soon be called the land of Israel and the spiritual land in which human beings walk with God. The word blessing overwhelms readers in this chapter 12 of Genesis and these particular verses. And the word blessing overwhelms us particularly in the promise and the command. The Hebrew ve'yeh bracha is both a promise and a command that Abraham will be a blessing, must be a blessing, should act so as to be a blessing, so that all the families of the earth will be blessed through him. Pope John Paul II, in his remarks to the chief rabbi of Rome in 1996, echoed the Torah's words in saying, quote, as Christians and Jews, following the example of the faith of Abraham, we are called to be a blessing for the world. This is a common task awaiting us. It is therefore necessary for us Christians and Jews to be first a blessing to one another. How shall we do that? By walking the path, I think, that Jews call mitzvah, by pursuing the covenant that we share. This covenant, the other great theme of the Parsha Lech Lecha and this week's portion of Vayera, this covenant with Abraham for the benefit of all peoples that follows on the covenant made with Noah and the children of Noah. The covenant with Jews is a specification of the covenant with the human race. It is intended for the benefit of that race, a fact that led Jewish sages 2,000 years ago in the Mishnah and the Talmud to develop an entire category of immense theological importance to us right now called the children of Noah, a covenant that includes all non-Jews who share the knowledge of God as God is variously conceived, who are in covenant with God, who share basic laws of human society and civilization. This covenant is with them, with all of us. The rabbis proclaimed 2,000 years ago, and we all have to reiterate it now, that one does not have to be a Jew to be good. One does not have to be a Jew to have access to God. One does not have to be a Jew to have access to salvation in the world to come, whatever that salvation proves to be. What is more, in the portion that we're going to read this coming week in Vayera is significant, perhaps more so now than ever before. The Torah does not tell us the story of the first covenanted child being Isaac. The first covenanted child of Abraham, marked by the sign of circumcision, is in fact Ishmael, the consequence of which is that Jews to this day share the sign of the covenant, and not just the covenant, with a billion and more Muslim males. The sign of the covenant could have begun with Isaac. It begins with Ishmael. And the word of God might just have come to Abraham or just to Abraham and Sarah. But it's significant that in this week's Parsha, it comes not once but twice to Hagar, a woman, a servant woman, an outsider to the covenant thus far. It comes to Hagar for the safeguarding of her life and that of her son Ishmael. This is a God who cares for all human creatures and commands every member of the covenant to use that covenant for the benefit of all human creatures. We have a lot of work to be done in this regard. The Torah teaches that all of us are needed for this task. I don't think one can state the mitzvah, the commandment that is imperative for all of us to proceed on the basis of more forcefully than Deuteronomy states it in the verses that we call the Shema, to serve God, to serve God's creatures with all our heart, with all our soul, all our might. All our heart means all we can bring to the task from our reason, all our science, all our arts, all our politics, all our economics, everything we can bring to the task, and it means all of us. It means men and women, it means Catholic and Jew, it means gay and straight. Everyone in this world is needed for this task of serving God. All are commanded in this effort, and those of us who take these words seriously have to reach out to others and gather them in their difference to this common task of covenant. This, I think, is utterly crucial to my faith, I think to both our faiths. The Torah wants something from us. It takes pains to let us know that it is for us, for real people in the world. As the rabbis put it, the Torah is not for angels. It commands dietary laws. Angels do not need to eat. They are proof positive that Torah is meant for us. But to that end, the Torah fosters our identification with the story. It wants us to feel ourselves heirs to this story, commanded and gifted with the task of carrying on the story. To that end, in the book of Genesis and beyond, it gives us patriarchs and matriarchs just like us, fallible, sinful human beings who are sometimes capable of great acts of kindness and altruism and courage, and at other times betray those closest to them, fail miserably to live up to their capabilities, are not the best parents, are not the best spouses, are not the best servants of God, and not the best citizens, hardly angels, but capable of nobility, capable of faith. Why give us people like this who are not goody-goodies? Because it wants us to know that the story is ours. It gives us a world we recognize, a world where minorities are persecuted, where Abraham wanders in chapter 12 into Egypt and immediately betrays Sarah in a very difficult way. He's powerless. He knows the minorities are persecuted. And yet again, now in chapter 20, we have another of the so-called wife-sister stories, where Abraham and Sarah find themselves in the land of Gerar, the land of strangeness. They are gerim in the land of Gerar. They are strangers in the land of strangeness. Their morality suffers. They don't have courage. But we all suffer as minorities, and we all suffer when we persecute minorities. The Torah wants to give us a world that we recognize so that we know it's to be an instrument for justice and kindness in this world, not for some ideal world we do not know. And finally, I would say in all humility, the Torah tries mightily to give us in Genesis and the rest of the Torah a portrait, a living portrait, true to our experience of the God we know and the God we do not know. And the emphasis is on all that we do not know and cannot know, because God is God and we are not. God, according to the Torah, is often there when you want and need God to be there. But God is sometimes there when you most need God to be there. God is sometimes there when the last thing in the world you want is for God to be there. You'd rather have space. You'd rather have God's absence than God's presence. And that is when God is most manifest, most near, calling you to account. This God, the creator of heaven and earth, amazingly cares about you and me, cares about the world, acts in history to set it right, and demands and needs us to do the same. This is what covenant teaches, that life matters, every single life matters, that history matters, that this world incredibly matters, and it's our job to be better stewards of it than we have done in our century or the previous centuries. This is the situation addressed by Nostra Aetate, I believe, and is exactly right that that document addresses the Church's relationship to all the children of the world as well as to the children of Israel. The Torah would have had it no other way. I have to say, speaking for myself, but I think for many, many Jews, that I most welcome I am thankful for the frankness of Archbishop Dolan's remarks this evening, as I was thankful when reading John Cardinal O'Connor's words from 1995 by his heartfelt honesty. I quote, "One has to risk being shaken to the roots of one's very being in dialogue such as this one. Otherwise, what we call dialogue so easily can be simply the equivalent of cocktail chatter." Amen. We don't need more cocktail chatter in the world. There is, God knows, enough superficiality and trivia in human conversation, and there are problems to be addressed, and if we're not going to do it honestly, what is the point? Pope Benedict referred in his meeting with the Jewish community of Paris to the fact that he shares a relationship with them that should be strengthened. Why? Because of that which unites us and that which separates us. And I would argue that that which separates us is just as important, if not more so, to the dialogue than that which unites us. And I have to say, I was struck again by Pope Benedict's directness and warmth when I was present at the ecumenical gathering that he called together in Washington, D.C. a couple years ago. We need candor, the honesty of depth speaking to depth. The world has enough superficiality, and that's part of the reason for the nihilism that Heschel talked about in 1965, and that the Archbishop spoke about this evening. Civility is a very nice thing. It's a very good thing. I don't mean to minimize it. It's a very important thing. The least we should show one another is the respect which civility manifests. But if all we do is wish each other a nice day, as every telephone message left on my answering machine does, we waste the opportunity to use our short time on earth with one another to speak words that are in fact a means of blessing, a means of carrying out the covenant. I want to say a word in this connection about the controversies that the Archbishop just mentioned that have ruled Catholic-Jewish dialogue of late. I hope and I'm confident that they will prove irrelevant to the future of Catholic-Jewish relations. They will, I hope, become a temporary distraction because, I agree with the Archbishop, we have much more important things to worry about. This dispute lately was not about the Holocaust for a change. It was not about Israel, the state which means so much to me, about which I worry every day and many nights, the place where I'm convinced Jews can know peace in a sovereign Jewish state, while Palestinians can know peace in a state right beside that one, a place where Jews have the opportunity to observe covenant, to agree they could not when scattered in diaspora. The latest issue pertains to the clarification the Archbishop talked about. To me, I want to avoid theological language, and I just want to speak, not for any constituency. I haven't polled conservative Jews in this regard, let alone the Jewish people. I can't even speak for all my constituents at JTS, but I think they'll echo my words. For me, it's not so much a matter of theology. It's a matter of what Martin Buber called I-thou relations. It's a matter of dialogue. I need my partners to dialogue, to witness to their faith, as I think, in all humility, they need me to witness mine. If you are a Catholic, I need you to stand up for and stand by your faith. I need you to hear the truth as you see it, as clearly and forcefully as you can help me hear it. I know, God knows, that none of us has a monopoly on truth. I don't need Catholics to tell me what I already know. I don't need them to applaud me for knowing it. I need you to tell me what you know and I do not. This is part of witness of Catholic men and women and the Catholic Church speaking as such. The lowest common denominator does not enrich the human spirit. It will trivialize it. I need you to be you, and to help me to be me. And if you are convinced that in the end of days, when Messiah comes, he will be the Messiah who has already come, and I have awaited someone else, I don't mean to be jocular about this, but I will wait till the end of days and I will see how it turns out, because I have work to do in the meantime. We have work to do in the meantime, and we cannot let this disagreement about what's going to happen in the end of days distract us from what we need to do today, tomorrow, yesterday, because there are people fearful and starving out there on the street. This witness, however, is not the same as proselytism. Therefore, I welcome the clarification the bishops have offered, and I think it's entirely correct. If you were to say to me that we want to talk to you, but we hope that in the course of our talking to you, you're going to come to see the light. You're going to come to see that you live in relative darkness. You're going to come to see that you really should be part of us. Then we're not really talking the same way. We will continue to talk, I hope, because I need you, because you need me. And we will talk even past that disagreement. But it won't be I-thou dialogue, as Buber understood I-thou relations. It will be what he called an I-it. It will be one party to seeking to use the other for its ends, trying to get the other to be something which the other is not and does not want to be. That is not I-thou relationship. That's why we have to carefully avoid the impression even of this, even if it's not the truth, but avoid the impression of it, because it hurts our ability to talk. The dialogue is needed. The dialogue has to take us forward. The abyss threatens. I welcome the Archbishop's suggestion that it's time, in fact, to move beyond dialogue to action. We do share a problem with religion in America today. We share a problem with American individualism. We share a problem that there's a degree of self-centeredness that often borders on narcissism, and it doesn't actually cross the line to narcissism. And we share the problem that religion too often is not an agent of good, and even more often is not seen as an agent of good. We share problems on which we have to take a stand, and I'm hoping that we're going to go forth from here and take a stand together on these concrete things and move from talking about what unites us and separates us, and I would say, frankly, move from talking theology to talking action. There's a wonderful rabbinic saying that Torah is great because Torah leads to maaseh. Torah leads to action. I'm hoping that our dialogue about what Torah is and should be would lead to action. In that context, I want to teach a little bit of Talmud. I want to teach a page of Talmud that is one of my very favorite pages. It's Tractate Baba Batra, page 10a. The context is the rabbis talking about tzedakah, both in the context of righteousness, what we owe one another according to the laws of justice as a member of the same community, and in the context of philanthropy, what we do for one another out of love. And in this context, where the rabbis have spent many pages talking about what tzedakah should be, we get this wonderful story. I quote, "The critic of Judaism may bring against you the argument, if your God loves the poor so much, why does he not take care of them?" It's a great question. And I would submit it's an argument not only against Judaism, but against all monotheistic religion, which insists that there's a one God who's a good God who cares for the world. If our God loves the poor so much, why does God not take care of them? The challenge, of course, is real. And it does not face polytheism in the same way. If there are many gods, those gods can be in conflict. One can easily account for poverty, suffering, injustice of war. The gods are in conflict with one another, and fate may hold sway over them and over us. Only monotheism is vulnerable to the challenge that Rabbi Meir cites, and Judaism all the more so, because our scripture insists that our creator of heaven and earth cares immensely about what happens to the widow and orphan. I treasure the fact that the Talmud owns up to the problem. It knows that the answer it provides at once is no answer at all. Why doesn't God take care of the poor? Quote, "so that through them we may be saved from the punishment of Gehinnom, hell." Can this be serious? The poor should be poor and suffer so that we can give them charity, earn mitzvah points, as you might say, and go to heaven? Not a worthy answer, clearly. And the Talmud knows that. If it were the answer, the discussion would stop right here and right now. It doesn't stop. It goes on for a long paragraph ahead. It knows that this is not an answer. It is, in fact, the beginning. Listen to what comes next. Quote, "This question was actually put by Tornus Rufus to Rabbi Akiva." Now things are getting serious. Philosophy has become story. A debate that might have seemed academic turns out to be a matter of life and death. For Akiva was Rabbi Meir's teacher, and as the quintessential rabbinic sage, he is the teacher of every Jew. Tornus Rufus was, by Talmudic tradition, the Roman general who put Rabbi Akiba to death for the crime of teaching Torah, the act that Jews are performing and studying as we read this very text. We cannot be neutral anymore, and I would suggest that Catholics stand with Jews in not being able to be neutral in this debate between Rabbi Akiba and Tornus Rufus. Akiba lost his life for conducting this argument. He must emerge the winner if our life is to make sense. Well, I'm not going to take you through all the ins and outs of the compelling proof texts that follow, as Akiba and his executioner debate the existence of divine justice. It quickly becomes apparent that if the poor are meant to be poor, as Tornus Rufus maintains, then might is meant to be might, and Tornus Rufus is meant to be executing Rabbi Akiba, and the Romans are meant to be defeating Israel. If the reverse is true, however, if norms trump reality, if right must have sway over might, we are obligated by the Torah to feed the children of God when they are starving. The fact of their poverty does not indicate divine will that they be poor. It rather reminds us of our obligation to take care of them. Akiba, of course, cannot prove to Tornus Rufus, or to you, or to me, that God exists in this world, that God notices our plight, that God cares about God's creation. But Akiba does have a very powerful proof text on his side. Isaiah chapter 58, the portion from the prophets that Jews read as we fast on Yom Kippur, the portion that reminds us that God doesn't want only our fast. Quote, "Is your obligation not to deal out your bread to the hungry and bring the poor that are cast out to your house?" And the passage ends with the following imperative. When must we do this? The Gemara concludes, we must do this right now. I treasure that word now. That's the key word in the passage, and to me, it's the key word in Catholic-Jewish dialogue. I want to echo as strongly as I possibly can the Archbishop's call for us to dialogue in a way that takes us past dialogue. There are problems in this world, in this society, on the streets outside this building that we had better address, and they will be better addressed if we address them together. I would submit that the good name of faith and religion, Catholic and Jewish and other, is at stake. We need to move from dialogue and argument about the terms of dialogue and obstacles that prevent us from dialogue to a partnership on the issues that we share. The issue, as the Talmudic passage would call it, preventing hell on earth. That's what the Gemara means. That's what the Talmud means when it says that if we don't do this, we face the possibility of Gehinom, not Gehinom in the next world, but hell in this world. We have to make it clear to all that God does love the poor and care about this planet. And the only way to make that clear is not to engage in theological argument that we may or may not win, but by doing good work and caring for another in the planet, in the name of our faith, in the name of our God. The key words to bear in mind from this week's portion, which tells the story of the binding of Isaac, are perhaps the three words the text says very quietly, but very meaningfully, Vayachu Shnehem Yachdav, and the two of them walked on together. May this be true of Catholics and Jews in the future of relations between our two communities. Thank you very much.
Chancellor Rising Smoking, so maybe ask Archbishop Bowen first to speak to You guys, Dr. Grisso, thanks for the opportunity. Dr. Grisso, my enthusiastic anticipation of your remarks was certainly fulfilled. Thank you very much for your eloquent testimony. You quoted Cardinal O'Connor that we do not need cocktail chair. But I can assure you, sir. Chancellor Eisen, I don't know if these are questions so much as comments and observations that came to my mind while I was listening to your eloquent remarks. I was very moved, first of all, by your expression of need for hope, and that I don't know if you use those exact words, but I couldn't help interpret your description of the nihilism that is indeed the enemy of both of our faiths to be that call for hope. You're familiar, of course, that was the topic of Pope Benedict XVI's first encyclical. And I just found in my, I'm going to have to go to a chiropractor. I was nodding so vigorously in agreement. When you spoke about that common threat that all of us have for nihilism, that there's nothing here, that we've lost our focus, we've lost a sense of purpose, a sense of drive. That's nihilism, of course. And I couldn't agree with you more. Religion, of course, whether Judaism or Christianity, is at her best when she presents hope. And that came to mind. I think there again is something common that we can work on to combat the nihilism that you so eloquently describe. Number two, I was very impressed when you spoke of the fact that in the minds of many today, perhaps especially our young people, religion is scandalous because religion is the problem, not the answer. I could not help but think of last week when I was in the company a number of times with the Patriarch of Constantinople, Bartholomew, who was, by the way, given an honorary degree from Fordham University last Monday. And I thought of his moving words, quote, where is it here? Violence in the name of religion is not religion at all, but an abuse of religion. You are so correct in the scandal of religion as being a cause of violence, misunderstanding, division, may indeed be the answer that both you and I, those of us who have a pastoral role in the life of our different faiths, ask about why our young people might be discouraged and might be searching around and leaving the religions of their origin. Thirdly, thank you for your mention of what we Catholics call the theology of negation. Simply put, there's a lot more we don't know about God than what we do know about Him. And you said that so very well. I would propose, and I would hope you might agree, that the only antidote to that, of course, is the virtue of humility. That we are perhaps most religious when we admit that we don't have all the answers. That perhaps our quest for God sometimes leads to more questions than it does answers. That doesn't bother us, even though for both Jews and Catholics, revelation is at the heart of our religious experience, our belief not only that there is a God, but that He's told us a lot about Himself. We know that at the heart of that revelation is the precise revelation that He hasn't told us most of the stuff about Himself, and that in many areas of life, he leaves us guessing, all right? That's not bad, and the humility that comes from that, from a knowledge that that we don't have all the answers, this theology of negation, as Catholics usually call it, I think brings us to a humility. Bravo on your insistence that maybe it's time, again, not to be embarrassed in dialogue for speaking frankly about what we disagree on. Though the few veterans of ecumenism can remember in the immediate years following Nostra Aetate, that the byword seems to be, oh, there's so much more on which we agree than that we disagree. So, which is true. But as you know, the unintended corollary of that could be sort of a blasé, least common denominator, as you used it, Arnie, a least common denominator religion that is then emptied of its pizzazz and its unique character. Cardinal Joseph Bernardine, whom you quoted, said, "The purpose of dialogue is not to become the other, but to become more genuinely ourselves." And I have found in my dialogue with my Jewish friends, I end up a better Catholic, all right? Because I also find out, because they will tell me, that the best way I can serve them is by being faithful to my Catholic beliefs. So bravo for saying that. And finally, my Lord, did you ever say it well about the whole necessity for giving justice? How moved I was to hear you say that the reading for Yom Kippur is from Isaiah, about the kind of fast that God wants. That, of course, is our reading for Ash Wednesday. All right? So there we have it again, that the real purpose of religious piety and religious devotion is to lead to the interior renewal of consonance with the divine design that would call us to service of others and service of the community. I don't know if I've heard anybody say it as well as you did tonight, Arnie, so thank you very much.
Thank you.
Good thing I have lilies and a beer, by the way. I think we're in a new era. It's very, one hesitates as a historian, both of us are historians, which is another neat parallel here, that you have an American church historian sitting beside a historian of American Judaism. It's quite interesting that we both ended up where we've ended up, of responsibility for communities of American religious individuals. What I'm worried about is that individualism not only has choice superseding what you call obligation or ontological status, the difficulty is one confronts religion from the outside. One looks at it as a possible option in life, which I'll consider along with so many other options. And religion never gained adherence by being looked at from the outside. Well, let's not say never. Let's never say never. Let's say rarely. What I'm trying to say is one grows up in a community. One grows up in a faith. One grows up in rituals. One grows up inside stories in which God is a leading character. One says, thank God, and means it, because God is part of one's world. And in that kind of environment, it's not a problem that there's science. It's not a problem that there's arts, because everything can be made to fit together. And one's not forced to ask the question of why all the time. Why all the time. But the minute one asks the question why, and everything becomes a why, and one cannot move an inch without answering the question why to one's satisfaction, it's very difficult to retain loyalty to anything. Now, I think our joint problem is that we need to give people experiences. I say this as an author of books, that books don't do it. Books can only get you so far. What we need to do is give people experiences of religious community in which they see two things happening. Number one, they see themselves moved profoundly. They see that there's a place for themselves in the world they hadn't recognized before, and there's a tradition which enriches them, which ennobles them, which makes them bigger than they could be on their own. And they learn this not by a book, but by feeling it, thinking it, living it as part of a community. Their space and time become sacred. So we have to find ways. This is what we're both talking about, Peter Berger here, that the plausibility structures, these mediating structures, these things that catch the individual up with experiences. But the second thing we have to do is recognize, I think, that human beings, and especially young people, have an urgent need to do good in the world and to see themselves doing good. So we have to catch them up in acts of justice and kindness, both acts of justice and kindness that are done in our communities by virtue of the faith of those communities, but also acts of justice and kindness that transcend the borders of those faith communities, because they have to know that one can perform a universal service by being a Jewish human being or a Catholic human being. and one does this side by side. Therefore, to link up your call with my call, I think the way to get young people especially beyond the excessive individualism of American culture is to show them that communities can matter and enrich the self and make the world better. We can preach it to them all we want to, but I think we're going to have to show them by doing it that we help them be agents of change in the world.
I think this is a good moment for asking you to join the dialogue. And so we just set the ground rules. We have a microphone that everyone is for you this evening. And so what we'll ask you to do is simply speak up and ask a question and try to avoid compound questions, which will... This is very lengthy answers. And make it clear if you have a primary response in mind.
Is the idea of the kibbutz in Israel part of this idea of human of being having the young be involved in the community? Is this part of what you think?
Yes, the kibbutz movement actually began as a secular movement, but sometimes the world moves in dialectical ways, right? So people who rebelled against their tradition end up carrying out essential tenets of their tradition as part of their rebellion against the tradition, right? So secular kibbutzniks in rebellion against God were militant socialist atheists who founded movements in the land of Israel that brought Jews together in what I would call sacred community. And Martin Buber, who I mentioned before, the person who taught us the notion of I-Thou versus I-It, was a great guru of the kibbutz movement, because Buber saw kibbutzim as a way for human beings to live together in communities. Today, there are religious kibbutzim, there are not-so-religious kibbutzim, and many kibbutzim, frankly, in the age when socialism has gone by the boards, have ceased to be kibbutzim in the classical way, and we're going to have to find community in other forms.
I might piggyback on that excellent example. Just before coming today, I was at a little meeting about something called ACE, which is the Alliance for Catholic Education. It's sponsored by the University of Notre Dame. And what it is a project, a very popular project, of young college Catholic graduates who volunteer to teach in inner-city Catholic schools for 3 years. During which time they will earn their master's in education. Now, the reason I bring it up here is because I think what Dr. Eisen referred to as this as what young people are looking for would be communal illustrations that religion indeed has an impact in society. What they discover about ACE is that one of the attractions for the young people is not so much the experience, yes, not so much the master's degree in education, you bet, but living together. Part of ACE is that they will live together in community, they will share resources, they will pray together, and they will have in common an apostolate, namely educating inner-city children. And this it finds tremendous lore in the young people. They can't keep up fast enough with it. So while we wouldn't call that a kibbutz, I think it would be yet another example of this communal radiance that we need to reignite if it's going to make religion credible to our young people.
Questions? Yes, over here.
First of all, let me just say thank you both very much for the talk, the presentation. I think one of the challenges in attracting young people into the religions is that there is a sense of non-inclusion, I think. I think there's a sense that because the religions are founded on principles that are so far in the past, there's a question as to their relevancy in today's world. Each religion having doctrine that may not be amenable to some of the younger folks. And I'm wondering how you would, in each of you, in your different religions, is answer that question, that this doesn't relate to me now, this is not who I am now, this is not an inclusion, a religion of inclusion, or this is not, the doctrine are not appropriate in today's world.
Boy, to use a Catholic word, bingo. You hit the nail on the head. I'm thinking of Cardinal Francis George in his new book says the major challenge for us today is to make timeless truths timely, and I think that's what you're saying. Maybe Dr. Eisen is onto something when what I just heard him say, reflection before last, what he said, reminded me of comments from the rather controversial yet insightful Catholic priest sociologist Father Andrew Greeley, when he said the genius of religion is that you have poetry before prose, you have story before doctrine, you have liturgy from life, and you have ritual that radiates reality. Now, in other words, how well said, in that it often seems to be distracting from religion when we seem to have imposed ancient beliefs upon people and a culture for whom such imposed ancient beliefs do not have much, pardon the use of a word that I don't know if in Judaism, but has certainly become a cliche in Catholicism, that do not have much relevance. Right, do not have much relevance. So, in other words, the charge for pastoral leaders in religions that rightly hold forth that we do have ancient wisdom that needs to be passed on. Both of us can sing the song from Fiddler on the Roof, tradition. All right, but how that tradition is not imposed, but that tradition flows from what is deepest and most authentic in the human condition. So there is nothing more timely, there is nothing more now, to use your word, there is nothing more today, there is nothing more, again, pardon the bromide, relevant than tradition or ancient wisdom. Because its truth is not dependent upon its chronology, but upon the fact that it flows from what is most noble and what is most true in the human heart. Is that I don't know if that goes to your question or not, or Barney, yeah.
I taught for over 20 years at Stanford University. I'm happy to say that two of my former students are in the room here tonight. One of my students taught me something about tradition when he walked in to my office and started making fun of me. Because he saw me working on a computer that was 5 years old. It was 5 years old. It was obviously outdated. And I'm trying to get him to take seriously a tradition that's 3,000 years old. What am I going to do about that? And here I have to say, I don't think Fiddler on the Roof helps us. Because the word tradition has come to mean a matter of nostalgia. Tradition is something you put on at will, take off at will, you do it when it pleases you. It's cute. It's nice. But does it obligate you? I don't think so, because it might get in the way of my free self-expression. What we have to teach is not an end to free self-expression. We have to teach that the self is fulfilled in community, not contradicted by community, and that like all disciplines, like every art, the technique can be the guide to freedom. You find yourself inside the guidance of these forms. That's a hard lesson to learn, and you don't learn it from books, as I said. You only learn it by encountering it, but you can't encounter it unless you give yourself a chance to walk in. My last several years at Stanford, I taught one of the undergraduate introductory courses. The kids could take a course on religion. And I asked regularly, I took a little poll, an informal survey of my 175 students. How many of you feel any responsibility or obligation to carry on the religious tradition in which you were raised, as opposed to being free individual agents who can choose religion for yourselves? You can imagine the response. 3 out of 175 felt a responsibility to carry on the tradition that they've inherited. This is America. And I don't think it pays to bewail this. I think what we've got to do is make our tradition so compelling and relevant that it answers the need, the hunger, for something more lasting than the ephemera that we have all around us. I would just point in conclusion to the fact that there are new traditions in this world. The fact that the Archbishop of the city of New York is sitting beside the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary. This is not a venerable old tradition in the history of Judaism. But it's already a tradition of, what, 17 years standing. And so one does not oppose tradition to modernity the way it's commonly done. One makes tradition live by carrying on in the spirit of tradition and doing completely new things that would never have been thought of before in the names of these traditions. But if you ask the Archbishop, if you ask me, I would say I feel an obligation to God's covenant to do this. It's a joy and it's the right thing to do, even though lots of our predecessors didn't see it that way.
Response?
Yes. First of all, with all due respect, Stanford is not the United States of America. Neither is Harvard or Yale. Neither is New York City. And I think if you look at the statistics as to adherence to religion in this country, the overwhelming, at least the significant majority of American people deem themselves believers in God or religion. Now, what seems to be a problem for Judaism and perhaps for Catholicism, I don't know, does not, as I read about it, seem to be a problem for evangelical Christianity. I'm wondering whether you would comment on what seems to be a rise in fundamentalism in evangelical Christianity versus what you've talked about as being a decrease in adherence to the faiths that you represent.
You can meet the woman, right?
I do my best.
You know, Stanford is not the United States of America, and one of the wonderful things about the United States is it continues to be the most religious country in the developed world by all measures, including the most recent measures. But we do have increasing signs that what was true of my undergraduates is true of many people in America. Now, notice they're not saying they're not going to be religious. They're saying, as you're going to hear a 19-year-old say, it's up to me. I'm going to decide. And a lot of them are going to find, as they grow a little older, that the return of the repressed, the parents' pull, the pull of what they have been to is much stronger than they might have thought. And they're going to end up in the homes of their parents. But increasingly, I have to tell you that the phenomenon of switching holds sway, that we no longer can depend upon children growing up into the religion of their parents. They may well end up being religious, but the increasing phenomenon is, as the Archbishop has said, 10% former Catholics. People are not choosing the religion of their parents, even if they choose religion, and many of them, more of them every year, are choosing no religion at all. So that is a problem all of us face. Now, I, especially in this ecumenical evening, I don't want to come out against fundamentalism, even though I have to say that my tradition is at its core non-fundamentalist, anti-fundamentalist in the following sense. And I believe the Catholic tradition is the same. We believe that our sacred text needs interpretation. I once took part in an interfaith dialogue, and the Catholics and the Jews on the panel were trying to argue with the fundamentalists about whether Scripture is transparently clear to all, or whether it needs to be taught in serious, complicated ways because it's not a transparently obvious text. I don't believe that the Bible speaks to us in such clear terms that you just pick it up the way you might pick up any other book. Yeah, there are words that are going to speak to you, but there are things that have to be studied and studied for a lifetime and studied inside the authority of a tradition before one can make meaningful sense of them. I don't think that the current surge of fundamentalism in America is going to hold sway all that much longer, and the evidence of the recent Pew report that the Archbishop cited actually contains that it's not. That the growth of fundamentalism has peaked, that fundamentalism too is losing numbers, and the fastest growing religion in America right now is none. Not fundamentalism, but none. And that is not what it was 20 years ago. I suggest that in a complex world of diversity and pluralism, exclusivist answers are not going to hold sway because they contradict the reality in which we all live. And the final thing I would say on this point is that one of the things I used to do when I taught fundamentalist religion, Christian and Muslim and Jewish, to my students is cite the examples, they're on the internet, of so-called fundamentalists attacking other so-called fundamentalists as not being the right kind of fundamentalist. In other words, you talk to human beings, individual human beings, and they're much more complicated than the doctrinaire statements of so-called authorities would allow you to believe. And I find this actually very encouraging. I find us living in a world that demands complex answers. So I think that religions that survive in the long run are going to be religions that thrive on complexity and meet people where they are. And people where they are is a world of religious diversity. And it's going to require a kind of religious tolerance that a lot of fundamentalists are not willing to display.
It's good you brought that up about the what we call mega churches. I don't know, and my Jewish colleagues tell me that they have some evidence of that within American Judaism as well. One has to look upon it with a certain amount of jealousy, and maybe we say, well, what are they doing that we are not? Dr. Eisen's comment, by the way, is right on target about. You will now hear evangelical or fundamentalist, and I know the two words are not synonymous.
They're not synonymous but, at all.
Yeah, that's for sure. But you will find that sometimes in the fundamentalist megachurches, they will now say that they too have a problem. Their main problem is stick-to-itiveness, that people will dabble in fundamentalism for a little while as part of the religious odyssey, but they don't stay there for life. One of the reasons I would presume that fundamentalists have sometimes a bit more of attractiveness for those who apparently are seeking it out is because by their nature, coming from the more experiential religions, this goes to my study of American religious history, they tap into the experiential dimension of religion. In other words, it's an experience of salvation. It's an experience of Christ for them, for most of the fundamentalists, that then leads to a free choice, a volunteerism, to commit one's life to that. So the experiential dimension and the whole realm of volunteerism, I'm not talking about volunteering for soup kitchens, I'm talking about that religious sociological term, volunteerism, which is part of the American religious experience, that we choose our religion, that's not part of a political mandate, as it was in Europe. That resonates with the American cultural experience that would stress both experience and choice. Those are issues, I think, that challenge us pastorally as Jews and Catholics, because that may not be as much a part of the rhythm of our religion as it is for the fundamentalists. This time, boy, what a great observation and a question. One of the things I think might help, and I think what I hear you say is that as a student who does see a consonance between her beliefs and her actions and service to others, how can you make that somewhat more magnetic to others? Even though you appreciate the fact that many students may be arm in arm with you in social service and works of justice, those don't seem to flow from beliefs as they do for you. One of the things I think, and I was going to bring this up as another area in part of my concluding remarks, but I had spoken too long. One of the areas that I think both Jews and Catholics need to recover, which is so strong in both of our faiths, is joy. Joy. Very often, let's face it, people of fervent religion are crabs, all right, and come across frowning all the time and criticizing all the time and arguing all the time. There's nothing that attracts curiosity more than joy and happiness. And the great French Catholic apologist Léon Blois said, joy is the unfailable sign of God's presence, which I think is a sentiment rather common in the Psalms. So maybe one of the things, and I'm not saying you don't show joy, I I detected a lot of happiness in your reflection tonight of your own religious beliefs giving rise to your actions. But so, believe me, I'm not criticizing you. But I am criticizing sometimes ourselves who often show religion to be a chore and a bore and a burden instead of a liberating source of joy. And once you appear happy, genuinely happy, you're going to attract a lot of people who are going to say, by the way, why are you happy? St. Peter, in one of his epistles that is part of the Christian Testament, would say, always be ready to give the reason for the hope that you have. Now, that's not a bad kind of mission statement. When people see our hope, when people see our joy, as I hope they see in Jews and Christians, they'll say, why do you hope? Why are you happy in the world that we got? And that allows us, of course, to speak about our faith, to witness to our faith. That was, of course, the great charism of Blessed Mother Teresa of Calcutta. She just radiated a happiness. And dying people would say, why are you smiling and I'm not? Can you give me the secret? And it allowed her to speak of God and love and purpose and hope and joy.
I don't want to speak later about that, but just picking up on that, we're reading about Isaac this week. Isaac in Hebrew means tuck. It comes from the verb to laugh. Because Abraham laughed and Sarah laughed. This man who was almost sacrificed by Abraham at the top of the mountain is a man whose name means laughter.
I like it.
He needed his name. We all need his name.
I like it.
I think before we return to you for a last few questions, I would like to ask one of my own. So far, we've been talking about the application of religious values within the two traditions. How can we collaborate in favor of man, in the terminology of Pope John Paul II? How can the two traditions achieve synergy in this regard, and feel of each other?
That was a big part of your...
Well, therefore, you want me to answer the question first. What I'm proposing, I'm serious about this, is I want us to take what the Bishop said. I fully adopt that program, and I just want to add this one piece to it. I want us to do some acts of justice and kindness together. In other words, I think it's very important that we not only tackle the problem of how do we address young people in this society, I think it's also a problem that we give them activities, examples of activities that are worthy of their identification. And I think that we agree that something that we could do together. Now, it's not as if there has not been Catholic-Jewish shared activity in the past, but I think this is a time, and I hope your presence in New York will be the vehicle, that we're going to do something big time, big media, big attention, because it's important that people see the example of this. I'm not craving media, but it's very important that people understand this. Heschel marched with Martin Luther King in Selma, Alabama, and made sure that picture of him was taken beside Martin Luther King because he knew how important it was for Jews to see a rabbi with a long white beard and a kippah on his head marching beside Martin Luther King in Selma, Alabama. Similarly, the picture of Catholics and Jews working together for good is a very, very important picture to have taken. So I think that we've got to be practical about this and not just dialogue, but take some action.
I was at a wonderful breakfast the other day that was lined up by a Jewish colleague. He had gathered about a dozen prominent Jewish leaders in all walks of life from the New York community, and we had a delightful breakfast. And I was very interested to hear one of the women Jewish leaders speak about a new program for our elders, for the Jewish program for the elders, that you're familiar with it. It's the new wave of caring for people in their homes, that people much prefer to age gracefully in their homes, so that instead of immediately taking someone out of his or her home and putting them into a facility, however wonderful that facility might be, is it not better, and by the way, she showed statistics a lot more effective and a lot more cheaper, to care for those people in their home, to bring them meals, to bring rehab, to bring company, to bring medicine, to bring a nurse every day, working tremendously. I then was so happy to hear her say that because then I began to talk of something that is just taking off in the Archdiocese of New York that we call Arch Care, that is precisely that, I just opened and cut the ribbons at an arch care center the other day, run by the Archdiocese in Harlem, that every day welcomes about 140 of our elders who, if they didn't have that care, would probably be in a nursing facility. To my great delight, the Jewish woman at the table said, "Why don't we do one together?" Now, wouldn't that be magnificent? And I said, "I think you're onto something. Why don't we cooperate in something like that?" I think would probably be more credible, more convincing of a society that often looks with a yellowed eye upon religion than all the words and all the books and all the articles we got.
Make some friends here.
Wow. Well, we Catholics would have a raffle about now.
Not an unknown form to the Jews. There's no thing I'm about. A lot of it. Of course.
Being a nun? What beautiful questions. I do think you'd be the first to admit that we probably could say, a faithful Jew could say some of the things about some Catholic families that he or she might visit, that, oh my Lord, they don't seem to have much faith, and I thought that Catholics believed in this, and this, they seem to be doubting it. So I think the experience that you speak about somewhat flows from what we've spoken about tonight, that we have to admit that there is a diminution in religious allegiance. And it's true for Catholics, and it's true for Jews. You have what you might call a nominalism now, where people simply might think that religion is a nice hobby are a nice name tag, but really has absolutely no formative or normative impact upon one's life. I don't think that's just true of your boyfriend's family. I think it would be true of many Catholic families. That indeed is a challenge. Where is the pizzazz? Where is the adherence to what we believe? I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not have strange gods before me. I'm afraid many of us do, and I think you've just noted some of them. Excellent observations. It's a consternation, a confusion that we often go through. And I also think you're right in that sincere, religiously thirsting young people, like you obviously are sometimes scandalized that the people to whom they would look to for answers, namely their elders, sometimes don't provide them.
You know, I did a survey with a sociologist named Steve Cohen once about American Jews. And we asked Jews, what do you dislike most about other Jews? Which is not a usual question that Jews ask Jews. What do you dislike most about other Jews? The most common answer was, what they most dislike is Jews telling them that they're not good Jews because they're not Jews in the exact same way that they are Jews. Where does this comment about not being a good Jew come from? Primarily from in-laws. So even where you both have the same faith, I predict that we would have this thing going on. I think that the Archbishop has answered you well, and but these deeper matters of the spirit and the soul come out most acutely in the relationships which are most important to us. And all I would say is you can't duck what's most important in yourself in a relationship that's important to you, otherwise that relationship gets trivialized. So the only way to work it out is to work through it. And I wish you Godspeed in working through it.
I think here in Philadelphia, but there will be a next year.